On Tech News Today, the European Union gives Google an A for protecting adults and children from unauthorized in-app purchases, but they flunked Apple. Plus, Amazon unveils a cheap new way to read books. Lenovo cancels a whole category of tablets for sale in the United States. We'll tell you why. And you may never have to wait in line at Starbucks again. Why? Because technology, that's why. Stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, July 18th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm joined by DJ Jason Howell.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you, Jason.
And the real talent.
And the irrepressible
in this group.
Don Reisinger. How are you doing, Don?
Oh, I am wonderful as always. Getting ready to talk tech, but first, Jason, let's dance.
Oh, no. It's, yeah, see, I need more warning than that. So I can't just make you dance.
All right, I need to prepare. The show, to dance. We're dancing.
Edit it in later so that he's not just sitting there with no music, bobbing his head.
Yeah.
We can do anything here with the magic of editing.
That's right.
All right. Well, why don't we do the news? The banter didn't really work out. So let's go ahead and do the news.
You screwed us up, Jason.
Sorry. I'll work on dance music.
All right.
I'll get you covered next week.
All right. Well, the European Commission said yesterday that Google is now doing a good job of protecting both children and adults from excessive in-app purchases. A big controversy these days. Apple, on the other hand, needs some work. Don Reisinger, this is something that all these companies are going through with in the United States with the FCC, and basically they're being told that you can't just have a system whereby children can just rack up huge bills on their parents' accounts with or without their knowledge. And now the EC is jumping in. Now, basically what happened at the end of the last year, the European Commission told Apple and Google that they needed to fix their in-app purchase system. And of course, in the US, it's mostly focused around children. In the EU, they specifically talked about, you know, adults that aren't really paying attention, and also children who download and buy things without their parents' knowledge. But this is really interesting because both the companies claim to have made significant strides. The EC is happy with what Google has done and very unhappy with what Apple has done.
Well, it's funny because Google and Apple are really in the crosshairs with the European Commission. These guys are on their radar every day, and they're looking at everything they're doing, and they're trying to find ways to, I think, reduce some of their power in the marketplace, which is probably good for consumers and good for everyone else. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. In-app purchases are tough. I do think, you know, when we look at the research, the models that the analysts and the forecasters put out there, they're saying that, you know, freemium apps are going to become the norm. They're going to become far more popular in the coming years. They'll become a key component in how we use mobile apps. And so in-app purchases are going to play a crucial role in all of that. And to see Apple not necessarily playing as nicely as it could with the EU, and seeing Google, who has been spanked by the EU on numerous occasions, move a little more quickly, I don't think is all that surprising. But Apple, I think, will have no choice but to play nice. Because, look, it knows that the EC is after Apple. It knows that in some way or another, it's going to find a way to find it and find it big. I think this is just one more in a long list of things that Apple and Google are both going to be targeted for. So why not just accept it, move on, and just give them what they want? Because I think that is ultimately what the EC is going to get, what it wants.
Absolutely. And of course, when the FCC in the United States slammed Amazon for this same issue, Amazon said, hey, we'll see you in court. And then And then they got sued, and that case is going to be coming up. But let me just read to you. Of course, this is just talk at this point. The EC was commenting. It was a follow-up based on what they said earlier late last year. And now they're following up with some information about what they have judged to be the situation. Here's what they said about Apple. Although regrettably no concrete and immediate solutions have been made by Apple to date to address the concerns linked in particular to payment authorization, Apple has proposed to address those concerns. However, no firm commitment and no timing have been provided for the implementation of such possible future changes. Apple responded by saying the parental controls in iOS are strong, intuitive, and customizable. And over the last year, we made sure any app which enables customers to make in-app purchases is clearly marked. We've also created a kids section on the App Store with even stronger protection to cover apps designed for children younger than 13. So essentially what I understand is happening here is that the European authorities have said Apple promised to do something, but they haven't said when they're going to do it. And Apple is saying, we did it. We already did it. We already have great protections in place. So that's a direct conflict, and we can expect more. Now, some of the things that Google did is actually pretty impressive. For example, Google they changed their policy on the labeling of games that have the possibility of in-app purchases. So if a free app that allows in-app purchases is placed on the Google Play Store, it won't be labeled as a free app. Because right. You could pay buy for things. That's a pretty major step I think they've taken. They've also, they've also encouraged developers to discourage from direct exhortation to children. In other words, selling to kids. By default, each in-app purchase needs fresh authorization. So you have to, you know, essentially approve it with a password and so on. And Apple requires a password after 15 minutes. So if kids get there and serially buy a bunch of stuff, they can do that as long as it's with each new purchase, each new download is within 15 minutes of the last one. So,
Mike, have you learned nothing from Apple over these last several years? They're never wrong. They don't do anything wrong. They've never done anything wrong. They've already done the things they need to do, and we should all just accept that, Mike. Don't you know this by now? You know this? Answer the question, Mike. Answer it.
Yes, I know it. And also Amazon is another one. Of course, Amazon is less of a presence in the EU, and that's why they're not really being part of this too much. But they're very much like Apple. They basically say, we already, you know, here's the fundamental problem. It's kind of this anti-regulation thing that exists, especially within technology companies. You know, Google tends to be anti-regulation, but then they're flexible when they're put in the corner. Whereas Apple and Amazon say, hey, we've already done all this stuff. And the regulatory authorities, both in the United States and in Europe, say, well, at least in the United States, the EU is saying that Apple hasn't done enough. But in the United States, the FCC is saying, we don't care what you've done. We want this locked down into the rules that are established, and so you can't just change your mind easily later. So all these companies that start with a letter A are very prickly about this sort of thing and don't like to be told what to do, and they're going to resist all the way to the end. So I think this is going to be an interesting battle coming up between the EU and
Mike, one
and
quick
Apple.
Point, real quick, yep. Real quick point, and I think this is something that we need to keep an eye on as people that watch this stuff, and that is, you know, the FCC is like you said, trying to take the right steps, but I really honestly believe that the EU is doing a much better job of policing these companies than the United States has done. I think that the European Commission has really understood some of the issues with Googles and the Apples of the world, and it has tried to rein these companies in quite a bit more effectively than American regulators. And that's something I think is of concern. And something I think, again, we need to keep an eye on, because hopefully the U.S. will catch up here. But in the vast majority of cases, whether it's with Google and its search engine or with Apple and everything that goes with ebooks and everything else, I feel as though the U.S. is a little behind here. And it's concerning, to say the least.
Yeah. And I would like to offer an immediate correction. I said FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. It's actually the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, that is suing Amazon and that is cracking down on in-app purchases. Again, that's the FTC. And I apologize for that mistake. Well, in just a sec, speaking of Amazon, we're going to talk about a new feature, a new benefit that Amazon is offering its Kindle users. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is a really important app. We talk about a lot of apps and software out there. This one will actually make a huge material dent in your life for the better because they solve two barriers to getting control of your money. The first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of your money. It's in all these different accounts all over the internet, your stocks, your investments, your 401k, your bank accounts, your checking account, your savings account, your business account, your personal account. All these accounts are all over the place. So whenever you think about your money and how you're doing with your savings and your retirement and your and all the rest, it's very difficult to really mentally understand what's going on with your own money. And that's what Personal Capital is really good at doing, because it brings in all that information and puts it together in a single set of intuitive graphs and charts so you can really see what's going on. You can see not only what your current situation is at any given point, but you can also see where it's going, where the trends are going. And that's super, super, super important. The second one is that because it's so difficult to get control of your money, there are lots and lots of services out there that you're probably using that will be happy to take your money to help you out, but you're probably paying too much. Personal Capital will show you exactly how much too much you're paying, and they'll help you reduce those costs. Recently, Personal Capital announced the integration of its award-winning Android app with Android Wear, the wristwatch that Jason and I are currently using because we went to Google I.O. and we have evaluation units.
You're so cool.
We're so cool, Don. You have no idea how cool. And not only cool is we have the ability to use Personal Capital from our watches. They were one of the first dozen or so apps in this available for this. There are a lot more now, but Personal Capital is very early on this. And it seamlessly integrates with the Personal Capital app on Android. So again, how Android Wear devices work is that the Android phone app supports the watch. So all you have to do if you have an Android Wear watch is download the current version of the Personal Capital Android app, and you will have built-in Android Wear support automatically. And it's really fantastic. Now, Personal Capital is just the way to get control of your money. So why wait? Signing up takes just a minute, pays big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions right away. Set up your free account. Go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember, Personal Capital is free. There's absolutely no reason for you to not go get this right now. And it's also the smart way to grow your money. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of Tech News Today.
And tell them Mike Elgin sent you.
Yes. And right? Don, too. Don Reisinger also sent you.
Oh, yeah. And me, too. Yeah.
That's right.
Hey, speaking of that, before we get to the Amazon.
Although it's still going to be free, though. You won't get a discount on free. It's still going to be free, even if you say I sent you.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Before we get to the Amazon item, you didn't even make mention of the fact that I'm now a Twit model.
Yeah, look at that.
With this new swag shirt that I got. This is I have zippers for days. Huh?
That's a thing of beauty. That's a great looking shirt.
I'm a thing of beauty. The shirt is kind of nice, really. Let's be honest here. Let's just put it on the table. But next week, I'm wearing another Twit shirt, and I also have a coffee cup I'm going to be using. So tune in next week. You'll see the coffee cup. All right, let's get moving.
Jason's going to send you a Twit eye patch too. So, you know, look for that in the mail.
Then I'm in.
I don't recommend actually wearing it or having a reason to wear it, but you'll have
one. Yeah, you'll have one. Cool. It's important to have one.
Then I'm good. But zippers for days. I like this thing.
Yeah,
I love
great.
This.
Yeah, it's a great place to
play golf later. I'm going to put golf balls in it or something.
Yeah. Or cigarettes.
No, I don't do that. Okay. Please, Mike. What kind of things are you teaching the kids?
All right, so tell us about Amazon, Don. You've got some Amazon news for us.
Yeah, we do. So Amazon announced today Amazon Kindle Unlimited, a $10 a month service that will allow you to rent an unlimited number of books. Well, actually, there are 600,000, I should say. There are 600,000 available ebooks through the service, including very popular titles like Harry Potter series, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, all available for $10 a month. Now, this is not part of a Prime membership, which is somewhat interesting because a lot of the services that Amazon provides right now, like Prime Instant Video and others, are part of the Prime service where you pay for free two-day shipping and you get free streaming video and things like this. But Amazon is essentially bringing the Netflix model to the ebook space, and it's also including some audiobooks from Audible, which is another great service. If you haven't tried it, you should. Amazon owns that, but it's an interesting move here, and I think it's a smart move. The big question I have, Mike, is how will the publishers that have a very, very, very troubling relationship with Amazon react to this? And we know what's going on with Amazon and Hatchet. We know that Amazon in the past has had trouble with the agency model and Apple and the ebook price fixing and that whole thing, that whole fiasco. Obviously, the publishers have signed on to this because they're allowing their books to be offered through this program. There are 600,000 books. But the big question I have is, after a while and after people sign up for this and things get moving, how will they respond to the idea that people can literally take out 4 or 5 books, pay nothing except for their $10 a month, not have any due dates, and read at their leisure without having to buy any of those books that right now they would be buying?
I question whether this is a wise move. Of course, Amazon is super smart. I'm sure they know what they're doing, but I just can't see the logic in this simply because, you know, this is clearly targeted at heavy reading cheapskates. And lots of people choose books based on the price. They're so sensitive toward price that they'll, you know, buy the book that's outside in front of the bookstore on the shelf that's like, you know, $1 a book or whatever, and they'll buy it because it's $1. And this is a case in which you have heavy reading people, the kind of people that Amazon should be trying to court as paying customers for Amazon. And here they are giving them an option. So the way this works is actually kind of amazing, really. So if you sign up and you're logged in Amazon as a paid subscriber for this service, you encounter books and it basically have a special link that says read for free. And so then you download it and you can read it. And otherwise, you'd have to pay for it, or you'd have to buy another book that you'd have to pay for. But I just see this cannibalizing their paid ebooks business, and I don't
I don't think that matters. I think that's what we're finding out here. I don't think Amazon cares. I think if we read between the lines of this announcement, it's Amazon really doesn't care about the ebook business as much as you think. That the money it's making in the ebooks is not as major as we had maybe thought. And Amazon sees this more as a small component in a much broader business. It brings people more into the Amazon fold. It makes them more loyal to Amazon and therefore gets them to buy more product on Amazon, gets them to pick up the smartphones and the tablets the company's offering. I think this is a play for the customers that are doing other things. I think what this tells us is that from a digital perspective, Amazon is more than willing to take potentially a loss to make more money on the back end with hard physical goods that people are buying on the service. So, you know, it's the old, I think it's a model that's interesting, and it's a bit of a shift because I think Amazon's saying what we really want is for people to come to our store, look at the books that we offer. And oh, by the way, you can also buy these 7 other things that happen to be available, including, you know, your deodorant and your hairbrush and everything else. Maybe this is still showing us that first and foremost, Amazon is an e-marketplace. It's an e-retailer, and that is what it cares most about. And everything beyond that is just a way to facilitate bringing more people into the fold and becoming more, again, more loyal to Amazon.
It's an interesting idea you've got there, which is similar to the music business. You can't make money on music itself, but once you get fans who care about somebody's music, a singer or a band or whatever, then you can sell them other things like Beats headphones and all this stuff. We've talked about this endlessly around the Beats acquisition by Apple. And so that's an interesting model. But personally, I always fear that Amazon is a rapacious monopolist. And you see what they, you know, again, I go back to this example because it's so stark and so little understood and so underreported. But the way that Amazon acquired diapers.com, Amazon was selling diapers, diapers.com was selling diapers. So Amazon put an algorithm against diapers.com that would automatically lower Amazon prices, no matter what the cost that Amazon paid, to undercut the prices of diapers.com. So there was never a case in which diapers.com was cheaper than Amazon. The value of the company plummeted, and then Amazon bought them for pennies on the dollar. And now they own diapers.com. That's the kind of company Amazon is, okay? And this is a case where what are these ebooks that they're giving away for free as part of the service? It's not, you know, Hachette. It's not the big publishers. It's a lot of them, a huge number of them, are actually the books that have been developed through Amazon's own system, where you go as an author and you use Amazon services for editing and Amazon services for book design and all the rest. They have a bunch of different services for that. And so it's really skewed heavily toward the alternative to the traditional publishing industry. In other words, is this thing a long-term play to continue to destroy the publishing industry. that's my deep, dark fear. I don't know for sure that it's true. And again, Amazon will always say that this is pro-customer. This is pro-reader. We are finding a way to lower the price of books, and that's a good thing. That's what they would argue. And they make a good point, and it's a point that can be made. But I, at the end of the day, I can't help but fear that this is yet another way. Like, they've sold ebooks in the past for less than the price that they paid. Why would you do that unless you're trying to undercut somebody, unless you're trying to drive somebody else out of business? Why would you lose money on a book? And Amazon has been doing this for years. So I think this is just another way for them to lose money in the short term so that they can own everything in the long term.
Now, Mike, you are the cynic of the day, and I love it. I love everything you just said. I think you might be onto something here. Look, I agree with you. Amazon is really, really concerning in a lot of ways. We talked about the smartphone and all of the privacy issues there. We're talking now about this. I think you're onto something. I don't know what else to say. I think you're onto something. I could see. I think these whether it's the music business, the publishers, the movie industry, they are under attack. Apple has been the one that I think has been most effective at attacking those industries, especially the music industry. But now, maybe you're right. Maybe this is Amazon's way of saying, hey, you remember that whole ebook price fixing thing that you guys were trying to screw us over? Well, we have something else we want to do. And by the time this is all said and done, we're going to be the ones that authors are going to be turning to publish books. We're going to be the ones that are going to buy you out. And we are going to fundamentally change book publishing forever. That's an interesting idea. And it's an interesting concept. And it's something that could very well play out. Because these publishers are lost in space when it comes to digital initiatives. And maybe they're not seeing it the way you are. I think you should go and talk to those companies.
Maybe I should write a book about it.
Write a book. Publish it on Amazon and write a book.
Exactly. The other killer aspect to this, of course, is that they have a free 30-day trial for this. So you can try it for free for 30 days. And if you have some time off, take a vacation, and want to read lots of books, this is a way to do that for free. Well, Lenovo has stopped selling small Windows tablets in the U.S. The reason? Nobody cares, according to the company. This is a kind of an odd story, Don Reisinger, because essentially Lenovo is saying that, look, you know, when it comes to Android tablets, people love the 7 and 8-inch form factors. They're gobbling them up. But when it comes to Windows 8.1 on those size devices, anything smaller than 10 inches, the market in the United States is so moribund that nobody is not even worth trying. Now, they're going to continue to sell devices under 10 inches in other markets like Japan, China, you name it, emerging markets. But the U.S. is a no-go, and they've just simply pulled the plug. We're talking specifically about the ThinkPad 8, which just started shipping in October, and also the Mix 2, which they've essentially canceled. They're going to continue to sell both the ThinkPad 10 and the Mix 2, which is also a 10-inch screen in the U.S. They said those are selling fine, but they just the small ones are not very popular. Have you seen this as well? I mean, what is it about the Windows tablets that don't lend themselves to a smaller form
factor?
They
suck. They're awful. I mean, what else
are the 10-inch ones better? I mean, they're saying the 10-inch ones are selling better.
No, they're all awful. Please, try to go get a Surface, and you'll want to dump it out the window. I've tried these things. They're awful. I'm telling you, Windows is not the platform for this right now. And I think Nadella and company understand that, and they know that. Now, what's interesting about this to me is that Nadella, if I'm not mistaken, said in his 3,000-word manifesto that really, when we're talking mobile, the smaller end, or was it Stephen Elop, one or the other, said that the lower end of the tablet market is part of the growth area. They said the same thing about smartphones. Budget smartphones are going to drive Windows Phone. It's interesting to me that a company like Lenovo, which is one of the largest, is it the largest PC maker in the world, or they're still jostling for first place with HP?
No, they're the largest.
They're now the largest. So, you know, it's interesting to me that Lenovo, of all companies, the one that relies so heavily on Windows, is saying, yeah, this isn't working out. This just isn't working out. But the reality is they're not that good of a platform. Yeah. I just don't see Windows devices working in mobile. And you look at what Microsoft says. We're a mobile-first, cloud-first company. But really, ultimately, what they're saying is we're a mobile-first, cloud-first platform company. And I think this is going to hurt Microsoft very, very deeply, because if they cannot capitalize on the lower end of the market, which is a key segment of that market, and they're not delivering the proper platform to these vendors that ultimately want to sell products to those customers that are buying the lower end of the tablets, that is deep, deep trouble. But there's one other point to make here. Let's not forget that Microsoft does profit a little bit on every single Android device that's sold because of licensing. So at the end of the day, Microsoft might say it's not a big deal, but I think it's something that they're looking at. They're saying, okay, when we talk about mobile first and mobile matters and mobile is everything, how are we going to fix this problem? But the first step in fixing that problem is ultimately going to be getting the right platform onto these devices. Windows 8 is a mess. Windows 8.1 is a mess. It doesn't work for mobile products, and it's not going to. So let's find something else, Windows 9 probably, that we'll see maybe the end of this year or early next year, that might actually appeal to people who want tablets. Microsoft is in a bad way in mobile, and I just don't see right now any particular way that they're going to get out of this real issue in tablets.
It's really interesting that Microsoft recently had an event which they hinted would announce something small. Everybody said, "Oh, here comes the Surface Mini," and there were rumors, pretty solid rumors, that they were getting ready to announce a Surface Mini, and then they didn't announce a Surface Mini, and everybody thought, "Well, what's going on? They were supposed to announce that." And I have the feeling that they may have come to the same conclusion that Lenovo did, which is that nobody wants a Surface Mini. And personally, I think that the solution for Microsoft, if they're smart, and they might be now with Satya Nadella at the helm, I mean, they did pull the plug on this thing. I think that I would guess that Steve Ballmer would have plowed forward with the announcement. But if they're smart, I think what they'll do is they'll go phablet. They'll have a Windows phone device that's 7 inches, and then they'll combine that with a smartwatch, a Microsoft smartwatch that enables most of the functionality of a phone. So you can leave the tablet tucked away wherever it is you carry your tablet, and you can just do most of the phone functions that, chatting, sending text messages, getting status updates from Facebook and so on your watch. And figure out a way to make Windows Phone more powerful, more usable as a tablet. I think that will be more powerful. And that way, also you can lower the cost, because the Microsoft keeps trying to reduce the power requirements of Windows Phone devices. And I think that something like that, some direction like that, is better than trying to cram Windows onto a tiny tablet, which, again, nobody wants that. So...
Yeah, Mike, you look at Microsoft, they're a mess. The whole place is a mess. Even after these layoffs, even with Nadella, I think Nadella is probably ripping his hair out if he had any. That's probably why he doesn't have any hair, actually. He's probably just ripping it out. He's looking at what's going on at this place going, what in the hell is going on? What did Ballmer do to this place? I think what they should be doing is inventing a time machine and going back like 20 years. I mean, at the end of the day, Microsoft has no real presence in mobile. There's no prospect for Windows Phone right now, except for internationally and in emerging markets, which could be huge, admittedly could be huge for Microsoft, but it's going to take a long time. It's a slow burn. Investors are looking at what Nadella is doing now. They're saying, we need some results because we haven't had any in the last several years. How much longer can Microsoft rely on the profits from Office and the profits from Windows before it finally realizes that it's way too big, it's way too bloated, it has way too many moving parts, and it needs to be a smaller, more agile company? That's part of what he said in his note, that, we want to make this a shorter company. We want to make decisions more quickly. We want to give project managers more responsibility. That's fine. But the company's still huge, huge, and it's working on too many things. It's trying to do too much. And the problem is, it needs to feed the investors. The investors are probably the Achilles heel at Microsoft, because they still need these huge profits. They still expect these huge profits. They care too much about the shares, and that's a problem. Nadella is going to have to eventually come out and say, look, the next 4 to 5 years are going to be very, very difficult for us. We might lose some money. We might have to borrow some money. We're going to have to totally change our culture, totally change who we are. He's trying to make certain steps, but he's only dipping his toe into the water because he can't fully go there, because of what the board's saying and investors are saying. He needs to go all in. The only way for Microsoft to be successful is if he goes all in.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, You know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, it's a new company. We really don't know what Microsoft's going to do. We don't know what Nadella's capable of. He surprised everybody with the size of those layups. 18,000 people laid off over the next year or so. Absolutely enormous. It's been devastating for the Nokia and the country of Finland as right. well. So, it's a whole new company. We'll see if they can figure it out. And to a certain extent, I'm guessing that within Microsoft, they actually agree with you with that perspective. So hopefully they can turn it around, but it's not easy, a company that size.
Of course
they
do. I could run the place. Just tell them to sign me up.
I'll tell them Mike sent you. So Don, it looks like over at Samsung, some executives are going to be canceling their vacations.
Yeah, what's up with this? I mean, so Samsung recently put out earnings guidance earlier this month, sent out its earning guidance. Operating profits were down substantially, about 1 trillion won, which translates to like $800 million or something ridiculous. Numbers were way down. Revenue was way down. Profits were way down. And much of that was due to increased pressure that Samsung is facing in China, where companies like Lenovo and Xiaomi, is that how we say it? Xiaomi? I think it's how you say it, which is kind of like the Apple of China, kind of. They are gaining market share very, very rapidly, and Samsung is feeling that pressure. So all of that's happening. So what do Samsung's managers do? They turn around and they say, we're going to give back a quarter of our first half bonuses to the company. That they said, look, we obviously didn't hold up our end of the bargain. Here's a quarter of our first half bonuses. It's an interesting thing. It's unorthodox for the U.S., obviously, because, you know, I mean, who does that, right, in the U.S.? But in Korea, it's very commonplace that when companies don't do well, they give back bonuses, the managers. It was only a quarter, so it wasn't a major amount. It was, what, $3 million. So I guess, you know, it's not a lot for Mike.
It was actually 1/8 because it was a quarter of their first half bonus. So that's, it was 1/8.
Okay, 1/8.
Pretty token.
Yeah, so they're cheap. It's like, come on.
I love how they say they volunteered to do this. Every single one of 200 managers. I just would love to have been at that meeting and have the one guy being go, excuse me, I busted my behind. I would like to keep my bonus, please. And just have him be shouted down.
They just punch him in the face and they take his money.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of tragic because Samsung has been doing pretty darn good, you know, and it's just the market is not friendly to them right now. Samsung has actually benefited from the fact that they were a very early aggressive mover in all kinds of markets. They just ran rampant and were running away with the Android smartphone market in the early days. China is catching up, and there's really not a whole lot Samsung can do. So I think they're going to be giving back a lot of bonuses in the future. I don't think Samsung has any secret sauce or any special plans that are going to turn this around anytime soon. I think they'll be successful, but I don't think they're going to be able to keep up with Apple because, again, Apple is so good at attracting the profitable part of the market, not the big market share, but the people who spend a lot and are willing to spend extra for a smartphone. So I'm not sure how Samsung's, this is going to be turned around.
I think Samsung is living on its name recognition. That was Sony for a long time, I think. I think that's why we're seeing Sony in such bad shape. Things are getting a little better now. But Sony for a long time, you would talk to people. You would say, hey, you know, what television are you buying? I'm buying a Sony. But you would tell them, no, don't buy that. Buy one of these. Buy a better television. But they knew Sony. They bought it. I think it's the same kind of thing with Samsung. There is no special sauce. There is nothing special about Samsung. Their products are not the top of the line. I think the HTC One M8 is a much better device than the Galaxy S5. And that's a problem. Samsung has name recognition. It has notoriety, which has served it well. But I don't think that's going to be enough. I don't think Apple really is going to be the biggest threat to Samsung either. I think it's Lenovo and Xiaomi in China. I think China is the future of, well, it is going, most researchers and analysts say China is the future of mobile. Samsung is holding on by a very small amount right now to that market. Those numbers are going to dwindle. More bonuses are going to be thrown back in or just not given out at all. That would be the logical thing to do, I think. But hey, whatever. And Samsung is going to have to reinvent itself. I don't know how. I don't think it has the patents to do it. I don't think it has the engineers to do it. I don't think it has the requisite, I don't know, balls to do it. Excuse my expression, Mike.
I agree with you for the most part, but my own view is that they they have been a leader in so many ways. They, you know, they have had the best, other than the super high end 41 megapixel cameras, they've had the best, you know, reasonably provisioned cameras on some of their phones. They've been first with lots of features. They've been very aggressive in building in some really powerful hardware. The problem is that that sort of thing is ultimately replicable. You can have all kinds of Chinese startups that can catch up to those kinds of things. They can build really great cameras into phones. And what Samsung has failed to do that Apple has not failed to do is they haven't tried to thrill the super hardcore snobs who really insist on the top quality material. Samsung phones have tended to feel a little plasticky. And again, they were way early with the really large phones. They were way early with all kinds of really cool stuff. You know, give them credit for that. They've been a great company that's had some great phones. The problem is that their greatness is replicable, unlike Apple's. If you look at something like the Sapphire screens that Apple's putting together, who's going to be able to do that? They've had to invent so many manufacturing processes for those sorts of things. They built an entire factory. They've hoarded the world supply of Sapphire stuff. And so even if somebody wanted to come in and copy them, that would be difficult to do in the short term. And they've done that again and again. That's the kind of thing that's hard to replicate. And Google does this too. This is one of the secrets of Google's success, which is that Google comes out with features that are hard to replicate unless you invest, as we learned yesterday, more than $3 billion a quarter in data center infrastructure. Who else can do that? Who's going to compete with Google on that level? And so that's the problem with Samsung, is not that they don't do great things, that they don't do innovative things, is that they don't do things that are difficult or impossible to replicate. And so these Chinese startups and others outside of China can just basically see what works when Samsung releases something, come in with a follow-on product, and, you know, pretty much compete with Samsung. So I think Samsung needs to really work on that. They are working on it. They have two innovation centers in New York City and in Silicon Valley, where they're really trying to figure out how they can do stuff that's more unique to them. That's one of the reasons why they're dabbling in Tizen. They want to be able to have a platform that they have more control over, and so on. So
now the Galaxy Prime, the Galaxy Alpha, Galaxy F, whatever it's going to be called, the thing that we've been rumored, yep, you know, has been rumored for the last several weeks, that might be the device that Samsung ultimately says, no, this is our iPhone competitor, this is our HTC One M8 competitor, and this is the future of Samsung products. So there is that possibility too. We saw some pictures of the chassis, metal chassis, doing those kinds of things. So maybe there are some innovative features in that device coming up, but that might make us, you know, eat our words here. But I just, like you said, Mike, I don't see anything even in that product that cannot be replicated or bettered by any other company on the market.
Well, Samsung executives, don't get used to your bonuses. Don't spend it. Just keep it.
No, just give them back. I mean, really, and don't stop being cheap about the bonuses. Give half back. That's what I should say. That's what I would say.
So
hey,
easy.
What is this?
So easy for us journalists who don't get bonuses to say such things. Well,
wait, I don't get a bonus for doing this?
You do, but you have to give it back.
Am I wearing it?
Well, Recode's Jason Del Rey wrote a nice feature on Starbucks plans for mobile payments. Specifically, the company intends to enable you to order your drinks via the app rather than waiting in line. And this is really interesting. A lot of times when these companies, Don, come out with new services like this, they say, oh, we're just testing it, we're going to see how it goes. He specifically said, this is not a test. We are doing this. We are absolutely going to make it possible for you to order any Starbucks drink on the app. And then when you waltz into the store, it's sitting there waiting for you. And they're really, I keep saying this, and it's, I think it's really one of the underappreciated facts of American business life. Starbucks is a technology company. They're not in the coffee business. They're in the technology business. And this is another example. They are super successful with their app. They're one of the most successful commerce apps out there. And here they're gonna turn it up so you don't have to wait in line. Just walk in and grab your drink. It's already paid for via the app. Pretty darn cool.
Yeah. Hey, Mike. You know what's weird when I walk into Starbucks?
What's
so
that?
I don't drink anything that they offer except for water. So to get the looks of the people behind the bar and have them say, "Oh, what would you like today, sir?" I say, "Well, I want a muffin and I want water." They look at me like they want to kick me out of the place. And I don't blame them. So here's my question. Can I get Pellegrino from this app? That's my question. That's what I care about. I don't care about the Frappuccino, the whatever, the cappuccino, whatever. I want Pellegrino, Mike. Water.
I have no idea.
Answer the question.
One of the interesting, I'll tell you, I'll answer another question. The question that going to answer is, so how do they know when to make your drink ready when you order it via the app? And the answer to my question, not yours, is that they're actually doing a lot of experiments about exactly how long it takes and what the average mean time is. So they're using big data and they're using algorithms to make sure that they get the timing just right. And so the idea is that, and I suspect they're also using the location feature and ultimately iBeacons, because we've already seen from the Apple announcement that Starbucks is putting iBeacons into their store. My guess is how this is going to work is you can order your drink at any time. Let's say before you leave the house, you say, you know what, I want a Frappuccino with extra, you know, non-fat whip thing with caramel sauce and whatever. And then you shoot it off, and then you start driving to work, and boom, you get in a big traffic jam and you're delayed by 15 minutes. And then finally you get to Starbucks, you pull in there and they see you coming. They see that you're going to be there. And when you're within a mile, the thing pops up, the order goes in. They know how long it takes to make your particular drink. They know how busy they are and how long it might take. And so they slot it in with intelligent software to determine when to begin your order. And then they put it aside if it's done before you get there. And then as soon as iBeacon detects that you walk in that door, they know exactly when you walk in the door. Boom, put it up on the counter, and there it is. I think this is going to be really cool, and I'm almost certain that's pretty much how it's going to work, and that's the right way to do it. Now, I mentioned, Don, that Starbucks is a technology company. Let me give you some other examples. Gave you the example of the Starbucks app for Apple. Specifically, what Apple was showing was the ability to put an app icon on the lock screen, even for people who don't have the app installed. So basically, when it detects a Starbucks iBeacon system, the iPhone 8, this is, again, an experimental feature for the future, an iOS 8 device, not the iPhone 8, the iOS 8 device, iPhone 6 probably would have it.
iPhone 8 is going to make your coffee for you.
That's right, exactly. When you walk in, you see a little app there. And if you have the app installed, tapping it opens the app directly from the lock screen. If you don't have the app, tapping the app takes you to iTunes where you can download the app. That's pretty powerful for brick-and-mortar stores that want to use their app to drive purchases. So that's a pretty cool feature. They are installing 100,000 wireless chargers in more than 7,500 stores over the next 3 years. So Starbucks is going to be a place where you can just drop your phone if it supports wireless charging and have it charge. Again, you have to support their standard. They're working on smart refrigerators, smart thermometers, and smart door locks. All this stuff we talked about, the Internet of Things and home automation, Starbucks is going to be building a lot of that stuff into their stores so that they can see all this data centrally and control things centrally, temperature, all that kind of stuff. They're very successful already with their mobile transactions. They've exceeded $1 billion in mobile transactions 2013 through their app, which is really impressive.
Like, we get it. You love Starbucks. All right.
It's not about loving them.
How many more things?
It's about how technology, and this is one of the reasons why they're so successful, is their technology.
You almost just said sexy. You heard that.
Okay,
they're
sexy.
You almost just said sexy.
They are sexy.
Exactly. It all comes out. That was a Freudian slip.
And here's
don't try to play that one with me.
Okay. And here's the thing that I think is just the killer app. They've gotten in bed with, speaking of sexy, they got in bed with Google, and they're going to be installing Wi-Fi that's on average 10 times faster than the AT&T Wi-Fi that we've been suffering through in Starbucks stores. And it hasn't even been that bad compared to one of their competitors in this part of the country, which is Pete's Coffee and Tea. Pete's Coffee and Tea has the slowest internet I've seen since the 90s. I mean, it's like a 300 baud modem in there. And I complain about it on Twitter every single time and no matter what pizza I go into. And every single time they're like, oh, we're really sorry that you had a disappointing experience. Why don't we have a call and we talk about it? It's like, how about you just fix your Wi-Fi, Pete's? Meanwhile, Starbucks is going to have blistering fast Wi-Fi thanks to Google. So this is, and that'll be no doubt subsidized by Google. So anyway, the long story short is that Starbucks is, their app is going to embrace ordering, and it sounds like they're going to embrace iBeacons, and it's going to be a really interesting experience, I think, within the next couple of years to go into a Starbucks. It'll be very, very high tech.
Okay, last bit of news on the day. Mike Elgin is leaving the Twit Network to become the chief technology officer at Starbucks. So sorry to break the news so early on you folks, but that's what's happening.
I mean, come on. I made a deal with them to just pay me with a lifetime supply of unlimited coffee. I got the idea from Seinfeld, actually.
Yeah, we need another ad here. Get Starbucks on the phone. Who runs the ads or the sales over there? Have somebody get on the phone with Starbucks. You would talk for an hour about these people. It's amazing.
Well, actually, their coffee is not so good. So
tell me one thing. Okay, thank you. Finally. Yeah, thank you.
All right. So, we mentioned the iPhone 6. Don, sounds like that's coming up pretty soon. What's going on with the iPhone 6?
Yes. So reports suggest that the iPhone 6 4.7-inch model is going into production next week, and the 5.5-inch model is going into production in mid-August. So we've been hearing a lot. This is kind of an interesting story because we've been hearing a lot of conflicting reports about the iPhone lately. We've been hearing in one case that the iPhone 4.7-inch version, the iPhone 6 4.7-inch version, will be launching in the fall as expected. But due to production problems, particularly with the Sapphire display and with the metal chassis, the iPhone 5.5-inch has been pushed back potentially to 2015. Now, this report suggests that, everything's going into production. Hanhai Precision, which is better known as Foxconn, is going to be doing it. And they're going to be producing these phones. They are going into full production. They are going to be ready for the fall. The 5.5-inch model is probably going to be available in limited quantity, maybe a little bit later in the year. So it depends on who you talk to and who you're really listening to, because you have some analysts that say that the 5.5-inch model might come out at best at the end of the year in limited quantities. Others are saying 2015. Others are saying there are production problems. So it's hard to really get a clear glimpse into what's happening with iPhone production. It's always been this way. There's a lot of guesswork that goes into it. But the latest report suggests the iPhone 6 is going to mass production starting next week, the 4.7-inch model, which suggests we should be hearing about it. What do you think, Mike? Next month? Late next month? Early September? What are you thinking? Obviously, it's going to launch in the fall because that's when iOS 8 is coming out. But, I mean, probably sometime in the next, say, month to 6 weeks.
Yeah, I'd say so as well. Now, the news that it would be that the larger iPhone would be delayed was first brought to light by Ming-Chi Kuo, who's really good at predictions like this. And it needs to be emphasized that everybody glommed onto his suggestion that the phone could be delayed until next year. But he talked about that as a fairly remote possibility. He said it would be delayed. But I think that the timing that you're talking about here, where it's delayed, the larger phone is delayed by a month or two, is more reasonable than that it will be delayed until next year. Now, the big question, the elephant in the living room here, is will the smaller iPhone 6 have a Sapphire display? The early rumors were, right up until very recently, that it would not have it. Only the larger one would have Sapphire. But then Marques Brownlee had that famous video where he's trying to destroy that display. Well, that display was a 4.7-inch display. So then everybody said, well, the small one's going to have Sapphire too. But we really don't know that. We don't know what the history was of that screen that Brownlee got his hands on. Was it a test? Was it for the far-off future of the 4.7-inch iPhone 6, iPhone 6S? We don't know what that was, and so we still don't know what's getting Sapphire and what isn't. It's the smart money is that the larger one will have it, whether the smaller one has it or not. And if it does, why is it early? We'll see how this goes. It could be simply a how fast can you produce Sapphire displays issue, and that they can't ship them both because they couldn't fulfill all of that.
According to Ko's report, Mike, when he sent it out recently, he said that the 4.7-inch would get it and that they're having some trouble getting it as strong. I guess they're having some, when they drop it, there are issues with it, something like that. So it sounds like it is getting it as long as they can fix those issues with the Sapphire display. So that's probably good news. I think Apple has to bring Sapphire to both devices. It's invested so much in the technology. When we go back to what we were talking about earlier with Samsung, Sapphire is a technology that Apple can truly capitalize on and differentiate itself on. So I think Apple needs to do it. If this is the iPhone 6, we look at Apple's launch lineup every year, every 2 years, we get a big update. Then we get our iterative update the next year. I think it makes sense that Apple would bring the Sapphire to both just because of the investment that's gone into it. So I would hope that would happen. And that's what Ko is saying. But obviously, we don't know. Apple likes to keep things quiet, though they're not as good at keeping things quiet as they used to be.
Yeah, and it's hard when you're dealing with lots of suppliers all over the world. So we'll keep an eye on it. And I agree with you that they really should have Sapphire on all their phones from now on. And if they don't, I think it'll be a big error on their part, and it'll be a problem, and they would be rushing out a phone because they have to get a phone out there for the investors and so on. So we'll keep an eye on that, and hopefully we'll all have our hands on iPhones. And, of course, when we do get them, we'll be reviewing them on Before You Buy right here on the Twitter
network. Oh, just like your Android Wear watches. That's cool.
You are correct. Well, we got another interesting story coming up, which is a cautionary tale about the use of social media for certain types of people. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. I want to invite you to try something, which is to express yourself publicly. It's not easy to do, but there are lots of ways and lots of reasons for you to express yourself on a website, to create your own website. And you might say to yourself, well, I don't really own a business, and I'm not a writer, and I'm not a photographer, so what would I put on a website? Well, if you're watching the show, I can tell you right now, you're really interested in technology. Everybody who watches Tech News Today is a tech freak, and it's a lot of fun to build your own website to pursue your interests. And let me tell you what magic happens when you put yourself out there. When you build your own website on Squarespace, for example, which is by far the best place to do it, you're essentially inviting people who share your interests to come and join and share your enthusiasm with you. In the very beginning, though, you have little tiny amounts of traffic. So if you're shy about putting your ideas, your thoughts, your pictures, your observations, your opinions out there, whether it's a blog or whatever, you don't have to be shy because initially you'll have very low traffic. And over time, as you cultivate your interest, people will discover you, they'll start following you, and next thing you know, you have this whole community that's forming around your own personal website that you own and that you control. Now, it's very important that you have a high-quality website. Otherwise, you won't be able to attract a high-quality audience. So the way to do that is with Squarespace. They have 25 beautiful templates for you to choose from. And, you know, you just simply go out there and choose one of these templates. If you change your mind later and decide that one of their other templates is more suitable to the site you're building, you can just flip in the new template. It's really, really cool. And their tools for customizing that template are so easy to use. So if you're a complete novice, it's great. If you're an expert and a developer, it's great because you can customize to your heart's content. There are no limits on what you can do with a Squarespace website. Sky's the limit. Now, it's also important to know that if you're a blogger on WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and other sites, you can simply import your existing blog. So all the history, all the archival curation that you've done over time, it's all going to be preserved on your new Squarespace blog. And so you should check that out and try it. Even if you're just dipping your toe in the water and you want to see how it feels, you know, go ahead and import your blog. It doesn't erase it in its current condition, but I guarantee you that once you do that and see how your blog looks on a Squarespace website, you will forget about the other one and you will just love how your blog looks on Squarespace. E-commerce is available at all subscription plan levels. You can raise money for your nonprofit, cash wedding registry, school fund drives, whatever it is, or you can sell things directly in your own store. Starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And, of course, it's mobile-ready with apps that help you manage your site. And also, when your visitors check out your site with a mobile device, it looks beautiful and perfect because it's redesigned on the fly for the device it's being viewed on. Squarespace has live chat and email support 24/7, so you're never alone and trying to figure something out. Start your free two-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That'll get you 10% off the price, and it will let you show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of this show.
And again, tell them Mike Elgin sent you.
Please do. And I've actually been recommending Squarespace since long before I worked at Twit. I was saying before the show began, I'm a huge fan. So definitely check it out. Do it right now. It's a lot of fun. It's actually a form of entertainment.
We're in the middle of our show. It's so easy.
It's so easy you can divide your attention.
Open up another tab.
That's right.
Do it that way.
That's right. Very good. Well, a fugitive tax cheat on the lam for 21 years, hiding first in Mexico, then Canada, was nabbed by Canadian Mounties and hauled back to the United States to face justice. His name is Francisco Legaspi, and what gave him away was his Facebook account. Turns out that the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security, I've never really heard of that division, scans social media sites looking for such characters to surface. And when Legaspi started posting status updates and cat photos, the feds asked the Canadians to apprehend him. Legaspi pleaded guilty to all charges and faces 5 years in the slammer. Let this be a cautionary tale. They are watching.
Never buy cats. No, that's the cautionary tale. Don't buy a cat. It'll give you away.
That's right. And don't post other people's cat photos as well. We also have another entertaining video that sort of emerged during the show. Apparently, Google's iOS app has a really cool Easter egg. Let's take a look at this video.
And you go to the Google homepage, you'll see that the letters and the logo look around and then go into place by themselves. So I can just move them around, flip them around. Yeah.
Only on iOS?
Or? You just float around.
As far as I know, this is just the Google iOS app.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of fun. Impress your friends. Collect them all. So there you go. Well, that is the tech news today, plus a Easter egg. Don Reisinger, thank you so much for joining us,
Jason. Hit it. We're not done yet. We got to hit it. Let's dance.
I'm sorry.
You didn't cue it up. Jason, look, I got to be honest with you, okay? This is really nonsense. I asked you earlier on to do this. This is
we don't want to have to pay licensing. look, I'm saving Twit here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Someone's got to save it, right?
There we go.
The licensing will kill the place.
The lawyers were saying, yeah, Jason, do it. We could use it.
Right, yes.
Well, like, yes, please do this.
So Jason Reisinger is here every Friday. Thank you so much again
Jason
for
joining.
Did I say Jason Reisinger?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
No, pick another name. Good. No.
See what you're doing here.
Mike Reisinger is here today.
So, Don, I want to thank you so much for coming on Tech News Today. Every Friday, always a pleasure.
Every Friday.
We'll see you next week. Friday.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Take care. Well, you can choose your favorite way to subscribe to Tech News Today on twit.tv/TNT. So many ways to subscribe. And if you're not subscribing, what are you doing? You got to subscribe. It comes right to you on a silver platter and it's free. So subscribe. It's a lot of fun. And I subscribe to all of the Twit shows and it's awesome. You should do it. Follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to TNT@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.